And in many cases, that fear is an irrational fear based on a lack of information. KC2, Tango, Delta, Lima. Wait for the beep. K2RIW, you got it, John.
K2RIW, you're definitely right about that. You know, I'll definitely research it. I already read one article about it from MSN. I think it was on MSN. And, you know, it was a very interesting article. And it told, you know, about all the birth defects and everything, you know, that would cause. But, you know, that's only if you, like, work in a laboratory next to a 1 kilowatt antenna for, like, a few hours straight. And, you know, it does bother me about this, you know, all these transients, and that I work a lot with electronics. I have a, you know, workstation inside. I sit there working with electronics. It's all voltages, but, you know, there is a fluorescent light with the ballast right above my head. You know, sure, you know, there is the possibility of receiving transients, but I'm not going to worry about it for the rest of my life. I do live on a block with a lot of electrical lines ahead, and, you know, I'm not going to worry too much about it. I'll definitely keep safe. I'm not going to stand under an electrical line for, like, 6 minutes straight. And I think my antenna does meet the, you know, the FCC standards with radio waves. But, you know, I'll research it. I'll keep my eyes peeled, and I'll maybe do a few experiments under, you know, safety precautions and stuff. But, you know, thank you. Case 2TDL, 2N2RIW, TechNet.
6W8CDL, can I just mention something?
Yeah, I've got a couple more comments for Joe, but go right ahead, Andy. You got it.
Yeah, I'm leaving the car. Just one good example of how people just don't understand technology, and I think you mentioned this, and I've heard it myself. There are people that are afraid to use the microwaves because once they heat their food in the microwave oven, they're afraid that their microwaves are still in the food, and they're going to be eating the microwaves, and it's going to kill them.
Yeah, one of the many examples. In the very beginning, the so-called microwave oven, when first manufactured by the Raytheon company and the Amana division of the Raytheon company, it was called a radar range because it was a radar-like tube that was actually doing the heating inside of that microwave oven. And people started making jokes that, okay, I'm going to nuke my hamburger. I'm going to put it in the microwave oven and I'm going to nuke it. And one of the fairly smart computer engineers, a man who doesn't have a great deal of radio experience, one of the computer engineers at the IEEE Long Island Consultants Network, he got a hold of me about a year ago and asked me, hey Dick, when I turn off my microwave oven, my food is warm, how long should I wait to make sure that the radiation inside the food has died down? And he really believed there was a certain relaxation time for the food to lose that radiation. You study that situation, you'll find out that at the instant the tube stops putting radio energy into that microwave oven, within a nanosecond, a billionth of a second, it's only the Q of the tube and the stored energy that's bouncing back and forth in the microwave oven itself. Within about a nanosecond or two, it all stops. Is there any permanent change within the food? Absolutely. The food is warmer. You put your thermometer in it, and you've cooked the food, or at least you've preheated or heated the food. The food is warmer. But if you made the most sensitive measurement with any microwave hardware or any nuclear radiation hardware and testing equipment, if you tested your food until the cows came home, right at the instant you bring it out of that microwave oven and you think you're going to see radio energy or nuclear energy, absolutely not. You're going to see some thermal energy, because the food went in there at 40 degrees Fahrenheit and it came out at 120 degrees Fahrenheit. You'll see a different amount of thermal energy, but that's all. That's all the microwave oven is capable of doing. Radio energy, when it hits biological substances, the amount of energy that gets penetrating the surface and absorbed by the surface, let me drop, every bit of that effect that can be measured is thermal. Of those 450 references in that American National Standard Institute report, you'll discover that they've been looking for the non-thermal effect. They would like to find out whether or not radio energy disturbs the cells, disturbs the DNA, whatever. as long as you're within the reasonable guidelines of maximum permitted exposure, approximately 1 milliwatt per square centimeter, which is, let me think now, I think that's 1 square centimeters, how many square centimeters are there in a square meter? 10,000. So it's 10,000 milliwatts, 10 watts, 10 watts per square meter. If the radio energy hitting your body is less than 10 watts per square meter, which is around 1 milliwatt per square centimeter, same level, just two different ways of measuring it, you stay below that level, and there's a tremendous amount of 60 years of experience saying there is nothing but a thermal effect. And so an awful lot of what you worry about, let me drop, is not worth worrying about. And by the way, the so-called high-tension lines, the 138 kilovolt lines that are on those great big towers going across Long Island, and the distribution lines that are around 13 kilovolts line to line, 78 kilovolts line to ground, those three A, B, and C phase lines that go down each one of your blocks are extremely safe. That is a transmission line. When you put three lines together, the 138 kilovolt lines, in a triangular pattern, it's very similar to putting two wires side by side in 300 ohm twin lead. It's a shielded transmission line. Whatever current flows on one wire, the exact same current flows in the opposite direction on the other wire. Those local magnetic fields cancel each other. They're in opposite directions. It looks very open to your eye. At 60 hertz, that is an extremely well-shielded structure. You could have that high-tension line go across your dairy farm, and your cows are underneath those wires grazing the grass, and you think the cows are being damaged. And various people have done experiments to find out, is that true? And the answer is no, no, no. Occasionally somebody will think, gee, I've seen a slight change in milk production, and I think those wires are doing it. And you do that experiment somewhere else, you duplicate it in another laboratory, so to speak, the few times that they found what they think was a non-thermal effect. And the guy wrote up a report on that, a well-documented report. And you repeat the experiment at two or three other laboratories, and the experiment doesn't repeat. You suddenly discover it was a random variable. It probably is not real. So no one has found the non-thermal effect. That 60 kilohertz or 40 kilohertz AC ballast or solid-state ballast you've got on your fluorescent lighting, I think is extremely safe. The most dangerous thing that exists on a fluorescent light is the fact that the phosphor has no time constant. Let me drop. The most dangerous thing that happens with a fluorescent light is optical. If you have the right kind of a stroboscope or a fast-acting camera and you make enough measurements, or you take a fast-acting photo detector, aim it at your fluorescent light bulb, take the output voltage from that photo detector, put it into your oscilloscope, you'll find out that that fluorescent bulb is putting out 120 pulses of light per second. That light is rapidly flickering at 120 hertz. Not everybody, but a certain number of people get a certain kind of effect on their body based on their eyes seeing a flickering signal that's flickering so fast that you don't sense it, but still that flickering signal is getting into your brain, so to speak, and on a very small percentage of the population, it creates extra fatigue effects. There are people who will work all day long under fluorescent lighting, then work the next day under natural solar lighting, and one situation makes them feel healthier than the other situation. There's a small percentage of the population that has a slight psychological or real effect from the optical flickering of the light coming out of a fluorescent tube. An incandescent bulb doesn't do that because the filament of an incandescent bulb has a lot of thermal mass. And between each half of the 60 cycles that goes through 0 volts, the filament doesn't get a chance to cool off. So there's a lot less flicker out of an incandescent bulb than there is out of a fluorescent bulb. So the most dangerous thing out of a fluorescent bulb may be the optical flicker. And the radio signals that you're concerned about could very well be extremely innocent. When in doubt, keep looking for it, though. And read the literature, and you've got a darn good subject there, John. As you do your research and as you make discoveries, in our favor or not in our favor, please come back periodically and let us know what you find. Back to you for a final on this one, John. It's a darn good subject, and a lot of the public really... Wesley recognized, a lot of the public really misunderstands this one, John. So as you learn more and you tell your neighbors and your relatives and your friends what you discover and how safe 98% of what they're doing really is, and that an awful lot of these irrational fears are not well-founded, they're just based on a lack of information most of the time, I think you'll have some friends that'll say, hey, I like being around John. He's telling me what I want to hear. And he seems to be researching the subject, and he knows what he's talking about. He knows where the data is coming from. KC2, Tango Delta Lima, K2RIW. You got it, John?
Yes, indeed. I have heard of the flickering with the light. It has been known to cause epileptic seizures, actually, in some scenarios, as I will definitely research the subject. Because, you know, RF design and all that, as we progress in our science and technology, there might come a day where the Earth becomes quiet, no transients will ever be emitted from it, might discover a new substance, who knows, and, you know, as we learn more about transients, you know, the safer our neighborhoods can become with the technology we already have. All right, this is KC2TDL, back to net. Clear, over and out.
One other thing worth researching, John, is radon gas. Depending on which article you read, we either do or don't have a small problem of radon gas being emitted by the soil in certain areas of Long Island. And in some cases, that radon gas comes into your basement, and if you dwell a lot of hours per day in your basement and you're absorbing that radon gas, which is a truly radioactive substance, it could give you lung damage, among other things. There are not very expensive kits you can get at Home Depot and, I can't think of the name of the other company with the blue sign that sells stuff like Home Depot. Anyhow, you
close.
Say that again?
Lowe's.
You got it, Lowe's. You go to Lowe's, Home Depot, or many a website, you can buy various kinds of kits where you buy this container, either a short-term or a long-time exposure device, and you apply the thing to your basement, open up the can for the right length of time, close the can, mail it away to the laboratory, and they'll tell you what is the radon level of gas in your particular home. And if you find it above the number which is considered unsafe, 4.0 I think it is, and is that microcuries per liter? I'm not quite sure what the units are, but if you find it above that number, you know either not to dwell in your basement a lot or to apply corrective action. So when it comes to the potential dangers in your home, radon gas is another one. 60-cycle magnetic fields, radio devices. And by the way, many a person will look at the cell phone base station that's down the block for themselves, and they really get worried about that great big 20,000-pound piece of hardware, that 100-foot-high tower with all those antennas on top. They fail to realize that the cell phone is only radiating, let's say, a watt of power or less, but the cell phone is located a quarter of an inch away from their head when they're using the thing in the normal manner. Let me drop. And you and I know about the inverse square law. Every time you double the distance between you and some source of signal, I don't care if it's a light bulb, the signal from an antenna, or whatever, every time you double the distance, you get one quarter of the amount of power per square foot, per square inch, per square centimeter into your body. So by inverse square law, that cell phone with a fraction of a watt of power directly up against the side of your head, when you compare that to the closest possible distance you can get from the cell phone base station, assume the cell phone base station is directly next door to you, as close as you can get, on that 100-foot-high tower with an antenna pattern, which is a pancake pattern, aimed out to the horizon. But you take the slant range from your closest bedroom in your house to that base station directly next door to you, it's about a 200-foot distance. You compare 200 feet of that distance versus the quarter inch of a distance between the cell phone and your head, and you do the square law of that, you come up with a 10 million to 1 ratio, and the cell phone radiates a little bit more power. The bottom line of all that is the amount of radio energy getting into your body is 1 million times greater when you use that cell phone, when compared to living directly next door to that great big piece of hardware, the cell phone base station. That's the physics. That's the science. You stand in front of a zoning board and you say those words, and they'll look at you like you're crazy. How can that possibly be? They don't understand the inverse square law. I didn't say cell phones are dangerous. But what I'm saying is that if you think the cell phone is dangerous, and you want to outlaw all cell phones, which are an extremely good protection piece of hardware that we're all using, and you think you're going to make your community safer because you're going to remove the cell phone base station, that's really crazy. Your community will have a higher death rate if you do that, because you'd be amazed how many times a cell phone allows emergency services to be called in a 60-second period of time when you see an accident happen. It's a lot better than running down to a payphone that may not be working, or run down to the fire station or the police station and pound on the wall saying, we need help. Nowhere near as efficient as that cell phone. A lot of lives have been saved because of cell phones. And so people say, well, okay, I want all those. Let me drop. The people in Bayville, Long Island, are saying, I want all of those cell phone antennas in somebody else's town. Take them out of my town. That's what those residents are saying. They have a strong misunderstanding of what's going on. And so your friends and neighbors who live in Bayville, you're going to have to help them understand that radio and wireless equipment is their friend. It's not their enemy. It is saving lives, and it is not injuring them. They believe it is injuring their children. They believe they're saving their children or making their children safer by attempting to remove those things. To try to remove those things, they have to fight their village government, the county government, the state government, the federal government, the Department of Homeland Security, the FCC. They're fighting all of those organizations who will not let them do that. It's probably a losing battle. It's costing a lot of money, a lot of mental anguish, and it's not going to have a happy outcome. A lot of education is required, in my opinion. So, as you can see, you're on a fairly hot subject there, John, and it's not going to go away. It's very similar to many other prejudicial opinions we've had about certain races of people in the United States. It's taken generations to apply moderate corrective action, and the situation is not completely cured yet. I know that Wesley wanted to make some comments on all of the above. N2XJN, K2RIW. Go ahead, Wesley.
Okay, November to X-ray Juliet November. One is pro, one is con. The pro, 120 dBs of power from the distance of 10 meters is not 120 dBs of power from the distance of 1 meter. At the same mechanism, or equation, I might say that 1 milliwatt of power, 10 milliwatts of power from the distance of 1 millimeter from your head is different from 100 watts of power from the distance of 20 meters. That's pro. Now the con. Dick. Existence of the factors does not state of their impactness or the health of the individual. The typical number of frames of fluctuation, whatever, you name it, for the movie is 24. So the eye is not able to recognize that. So at the same time, the numbers of flickering of 120 of the fluorescent light that was used in therapy, and the wavelength of the light by itself created by fluorescent light is considered to be the one of the most soft one and friendly one to human being. At the same time, I didn't find any worries about that factor, and I did not find people contradicting this factor. They have scientific background. Back to you, Dick, and to HGM.
Yeah, what I believe you're saying, Wesley, is that for years and years, motion pictures that we watch in a movie theater are approximately 24 frames per second. The television screen we watch is 30 complete frames per second, 60 fields per second, and they had it backwards, fields and frames, but you know what I mean, the interlace thing. And for the most part, most people don't suffer any side effects from that flicker rate. And so when you get up to a flicker rate of 120 flickers per second from a fluorescent light, essentially no human being can sense that. That is to say, they're not aware of it. However, there are people questioning whether or not the extra fatigue some people sense when they do 8 hours of labor under fluorescent lighting, and they feel that they don't get as much fatigue when they do 8 hours of labor under incandescent lighting or natural lighting. Some people think there is a definite difference. Is it a wavelength difference? Is it a flicker difference? If you were using full spectrum type fluorescent bulbs, would it be better? There's a lot of controversy there.
You forget about something, Dick.
What's that? What did I forget?
You forget about the factor that these worries are not necessary, should be directed towards the flickering of fluorescent light, but to the existence of hundreds of the transformers that are sparky devices actually creating an electromagnetic field at a certain wavelength of electromagnetic electromagnetic wavelength and the power. And the concentration of this factor may be actually falling into this description of the bad things that could actually affect to the human health. In the same way as you describe cell phones. Am I right or wrong, Dick?
Well, I'm going to agree with you that the 40 kilohertz type solid-state ballast or the 60 hertz type ordinary ballast of a fluorescent light is a kind of a spark coil transmitter. The actual mercury vapor that's inside the 40-watt, 4-foot-long, 48-inch-long fluorescent tube is, when it's giving off light, is a kind of a plasma. And something in the vicinity of a 60 or 80 or 100 volts drop occurs across the fluorescent tube when it has been ignited on each individual cycle. But the ballast transformer and ballast inductor is there to give a higher voltage spike to make sure that the mercury vapor in the fluorescent tube will go into the conducting state, will go into the plasma state on each individual cycle. And does that ballast transformer and that current spike and that plasma inside of the fluorescent tube, does that emit a signal, a radio signal, that's harmful to human beings? Quite a bit of research is going into that. I know of a particular man living in Huntington who runs a consulting service in which he sincerely believes that he senses health effects by being in buildings that have fluorescent lighting because of the ballast transformer, because of the magnetic field and electrostatic field that it emits. Quite a few studies have happened along those lines, and right now I don't think there's a clearly defined jeopardy that's created by that kind of lighting to the general public. Are there specific individuals that are sensitive to that radio signal coming out of there? Are there specific signal individuals that are sensitive to the flickering of the lighting? There are articles now being written where people are asking those questions and making some measurements. It's not a completely open and closed case. In the case of fluorescent lighting, I don't think anywhere near as much study has occurred as has with radio signals over the last 60 years in the ANSI report. There are portions of the ANSI report that talk about 60 cycle. Let me drop. That does talk about 60-cycle magnetic fields and whether or not that is harmful to human beings. And the report does give a maximum permitted exposure at a 60-cycle rate. So the report, you could say, operates between 60 cycles and 300 gigahertz, according to the title on the front cover. It's got a very long title, by the way. And you go to the right website, you can read it. It's in fairly dense technical language, but it represents the compendium of what the United States has learned with interfacing with other well-developed nations, as well as the research that's going on for approximately 60 years on that subject. It's a very large body of knowledge that you can't ignore. Is it the absolute last word? Of course not, because every couple of years it gets updated and new information is added as it's being discovered. But I'm telling you what I think is known so far in that subject. And the majority of what we do is safe. And when in doubt, you can do research, make measurements, and find out, is your particular environment safe? And in theory, as radio amateurs, we have the responsibility of making a calculation of how many watts is your transmitter, how far away is the antenna, how big is the antenna, what frequency are you on, what is the margin of safety of your particular equipment. If you read the letter of the law of what's required for a modern-day amateur radio license, we're supposed to be somewhat savvy in that area. We're supposed to have made a measurement to be sure that our equipment is safe. And as I said before, to really become non-safe, you'd have to do a couple of very foolish things. Reasonably high power, extremely close spacing to an antenna, and stay there for ridiculous length of time in order to really get yourself in trouble. That's what I'm pretty sure you're going to discover when you look further into it. I'm going to go to the next person, because we don't want to keep everybody waiting too long. The next person who signed in was Bill. Kilo Charlie 2, Sierra Yankee Lima. Go right ahead, Bill. Sorry we kept you waiting. K2RAW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
81THM.
Thanks, Dick. This is Bill, KC2, SYL. Good evening to the net. I have several questions. First question, based on the discussion on the antenna, is there any research that supports that possibly the radiation or the radiated signal would go through the Earth rather than radiate through a sky wave and a ground wave? As you were discussing the antenna and the radios, that thought came to me, and I was wondering if there was any research to support that or negate that. Back to you.
81THM.
I'm hearing an extremely weak signal that sounds like KB1THM. I'm going to put you on the list, sir, but anything you can do to make the signal stronger would help. It's an extremely weak signal. Bob, does a radio signal radiate through ground, and does it radiate through seawater? The answer is absolutely yes. But how strong is it is the next question. There is a command receiver that used to be on almost all submarines that operated at a very low frequency in the kilohertz region, or tens of kilohertz region, which would, with a very large antenna in Michigan, and there was another one in Maine, would allow you to communicate with your United States submarine anywhere in the world, as long as that submarine was within approximately 60 feet of the surface of the seawater. You could communicate with that submarine, and you could say, please go to so-and-so and patrol such-and-such area, for instance. You could give it that kind of a message. So can you get a properly engineered low-frequency signal to propagate through seawater and through land? The answer is yes. However, the signal does get extremely attenuated. If I compare the signal strength of the signal that flows through the ground versus the signal that flows through the air and is bounced off the ionosphere, the air and ionosphere and spatial signal, in most cases, is going to be something like 100 decibels stronger. Rough rule of thumb. What is 100 decibels? That's a 10 billion to 1 power ratio. So yes, does a signal propagate through dirt? Sure. Does a signal propagate out of your well-constructed screen room? Let me drop that and explain that one. The good news about radio is that once you create radio signal and radiate it by some kind of intentional or unintentional system, intentional means antenna, unintentional may mean the leakage of your coax cable or the leakage of the cabinet of your transmitter. But once you create any radio signal, that radio signal goes to every square centimeter of this universe. And I'm not kidding. It goes everywhere. The only thing left to discuss is when it gets to the place you care about. Is that signal strong enough when it gets there to be above threshold of the equipment you're using in that location? That's the only thing to discuss. You use smarter and smarter systems and more and more sensitive receivers with more and more exotic transmitting and receiving techniques. you can have an extremely weak signal go extremely far. The best example I can think of is a global positioning satellite system, that navigating system. Each of those satellites are roughly at a 10,000-mile altitude, a big constellation of them going around the Earth. 24 of them are active at any one instant of time, plus a couple of spares. So you've got this constellation of satellites, 10,000 miles up, all radiating a signal that's only 10 watts. And it's a microwave signal, 1,572 megacycles. You study a 10-watt signal directly overhead, the best you're going to get, 10,000 miles away, into your state-of-the-art GPS receiver, the one that's in your hand, which has got a very low noise figure front end, a 1 decibel noise figure, 1 megacycle bandwidth, precisely on the right frequency. You're in a nice, quiet area. You're standing in a great big open field. You're holding onto this GPS receiver, and you're listening to that series of satellites that are near you in order to get the navigation report as to where you are. You study what's going on in that situation. You'll discover that you've got a no-interference situation in my example, no blockages. You're standing out in the middle of an open field. You're listening to those satellites. That signal, when it comes into your receiver, and it's a state-of-the-art receiver, starts off 24 dB weaker than the electronic noise that's in your state-of-the-art receiver. That signal starts off 24 dB of negative signal-to-noise ratio. Under normal circumstances, 30 years ago, any rational electronic engineer would say, that's impossible. Forget it. Once it's that far buried in the noise, it's gone. They would say those words. They did say those words. Let me drop. But now you come along with a very specific signal modulation with what's called a gold code. You reproduce the gold code locally and try to match up with the gold code coming from the satellite. You slide the timing of one signal past the other. You've got a 14-bit or something like that digital to analog to digital converter in your receiver that is digitizing that extremely noisy signal, where the real signal you're looking for is 24 dB below the noise. And because of the digital signal processing that goes on with that gold code, where you get something like 35 decibels of post-detection integration signal-to-noise ratio improvement, you study what that GPS receiver is doing. That 24 dB negative signal-to-noise ratio ends up being positive 10 dB signal-to-noise ratio, and you demodulate the signal. It'll say, hi, Bill, I'm satellite number 13 of the constellation of 24 satellites. This is where I'm located, and this is what the time really is. And this is where the other satellites are located. That's what the message is. And you look at enough of those satellites, and you figure out exactly where you are to the nearest 10 or 15 meters or so on the face of the Earth. Beautiful system. So what I'm getting at is I can have a beautifully constructed screen room where I do a thoroughly isolated measurement, where all of my electronics is removed from all of the radio noise and interference and everything else of my particular neighborhood. I've got this double-layer screen room with finger stocks around the door, all nice and clean, silver-plated, and I'm inside that screen room. Let me drop. And I'm 100 dB shielded from that outside environment because of the double layer of screening of that screen room. And maybe it's made out of a copper walls, whatever. And you would think that, boy, that's perfectly isolated. Well, it's relative. If I've got the right kind of receiver outside of that screen room, the signal I'm going to get from what you're doing inside is going to be 100 dB weaker. That's the usual rule of thumb. A good screen room has about 100 decibels of shielding. A naive person will say, that signal's gone. Another person will say, hey, the signal had 100 dB of attenuation, but if I've got a sensitive enough receiver and I stand outside that room, I can listen to that signal and know what's happening if I've got the right kind of equipment. So when it comes to talking about signal strength and whether or not the signal is strong enough to do what you desire, once you realize the signal goes everywhere, and if you design the equipment correctly, you can learn to live with extremely weak signals. You study what a radio telescope does when it's listening to a signal that's coming from 10 billion light years away, and you're making a quantitative measurement of the noise power coming out of that star 10 billion light years away on your radio telescope. And you suddenly realize that if you're smart enough, there's almost no signal weak enough that you can't do something useful with it. It's just a matter of applying the right technology. I know I didn't give you a direct answer, but I gave you some of the variables involved, and maybe I've tickled your curiosity a little bit there, Bill. Kilo Charlie 2, Sierra Yankee Lima, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Thanks, Dick. I appreciate that. I understand the difference, you know, in outer space or free space without a conductive medium such as air and so on. But I was when you were talking about the antennas, I was thinking more of the multi-kilowatt transmitters, say for a commercial station. And we spend a lot of time, you know, DXing and listening to DX and so on. I was wondering if there's any research or any validity to the thought that the signal would actually go through the Earth. So in other words, the multi-kilowatt stations, say here on the East Coast, you would listen to can be heard as a signal propagates through the Earth. And I understand the attenuation and so on, that it would be received by the receiver, you know, on the opposite end of the Earth, rather than through the sky wave and the ground wave access that we're so familiar with. Back to that thing.
Yeah, you're sort of asking, is the signal going through the Earth? And the answer is yes. Is the signal going through the Earth useful? I think 99% of the time the answer is no. That signal going through the Earth is really experiencing tremendous attenuation. Even if the band is closed, the signal that is getting to you, the super weak signal that's getting to you by way of sky wave, most of the time is going to be a zillion decibels stronger. Obviously, I didn't put an exact number on it. But the sky wave signal is going to be, most of the time, a hell of a lot stronger. Now, that answer is going to change on whether or not you're 1 mile from the transmitting site or 8,000 miles from the transmitting site. The answer is going to change. If you're 1 mile from the transmitting site, you have the ability to measure the ground wave signal, the signal that's below ground. Andy, when he goes into the New York City subway system, and he's, in some cases, 100 feet below ground, he could go into one of those tunnels of the Metropolitan Transit Authority with good sensitive equipment, stand in the middle of that tunnel in between two train stations. In theory, he could measure the amplitude of a signal being received 100 feet underground from a broadcast station like the Empire State Building that might be 10 miles away from him, 20 miles away from him. In theory, he can make that measurement. But most of the time, that signal is going to be so darn weak for his method of using of it and that method of modulation that the signal is going to be so darn weak, it's not useful. If he just builds an extremely narrow band receiver listening to nothing but the carrier of the transmitter, he may detect the fact that the carrier is there. But getting enough signal-to-noise ratio to get a picture out of that signal, or to get voice out of it, very, very difficult, very unlikely. So, is it there? Yes. Is it useful? I think most of the time the answer is no. And so, and you can find out. And let me give you another example about the craziness of propagation. And this is one of my physics puzzles that I've given quite often to the electrical engineers I work with. Let me drop. Let's assume that the Sierra Yankee Lima Engineering Company, a very respected firm, has accepted a contract to send a 10,000 megacycle signal, a reference oscillator signal, to the moon in order to synchronize the timing of the global positioning satellite receiver equipment that's on the moon. So you've accepted a contract to send a signal to the moon. And assume now that the mechanical engineers have completely worked out the problem. So what I'm about to say is crazy, but assume your mechanical engineers have solved the problem of building a piece of waveguide, 10 gigahertz waveguide, X-band waveguide, that goes from the Earth to the Moon. And so, and the waveguide is going to be made out of the best stuff you can buy from the Andrew Company, the world's best waveguide manufacturer in Illinois. And you're going to buy military-specified, silver-plated, 10 gigahertz X-band waveguide in 20-foot lengths, and you're going to bolt it all together, and you're going to send that signal down the waveguide to the moon. That's technique number one to getting a nice reference signal to the moon. Technique number two, it's going to use a little piece of wire, a quarter of an inch long, as an antenna to transmit a signal from the Earth. And on the moon, you're going to use a quarter inch piece of wire as a ground plane receiving antenna to get that 10 gigahertz signal on the moon. So now you've got two techniques. The waveguide technique, sending the signal directly down the waveguide, silver plated, mil-spec, best waveguide you can buy, versus the little bitty piece of wire radiating the signal all over space, and the little piece of wire receiving that signal through space on the moon, receiving it from all directions of space. The question I ask these engineers is, which technique would you choose, assuming that cost is no object? I just want to get a good, clean signal to the moon. Which signal would you choose? And one signal is going to give a stronger response than the other. Roughly how many decibels of improvement would one technique be over the other? I asked that question. And about 85 or 90% of the engineers would say, as long as cost is no object, I choose the waveguide. Well, you study the mathematics of the waveguide versus free space. You'll discover the free space signal is going to be stronger. How much stronger? 150 decibels stronger. Waveguide is great stuff if you're only using a couple of hundred feet of it. But waveguide gives you, at X-band, 4.5 dB per 100 feet, over and over again, every 100 feet for that quarter of a million miles to the moon. The signal you get to the moon is minus 51 million dB of loss. Whereas,
repeater, timeout.
Whereas in the case of free space, the signal will be 100 and some odd dB down instead of something like 50 million dB down through the waveguide. The free space works so differently. When you're halfway to the moon on free space, the way inverse square law works, there's only 6 decibels of loss for the going to the second half of the way to the moon. Only 6 dB more loss. When you're halfway there with the waveguide and you've got 25 million decibels of loss, the second half of the waveguide from the middle of the path to the moon, all the way to the moon, has another 25 million dB. Waveguide is linear in dB per foot. Free space is obeying the inverse square law. So propagation, when you study it, sometimes it's extremely different than common sense. Try that experiment on your friends, if they're electrical engineering friends that think they understand microwave propagation and waveguide and signal propagation in free space, the vast majority of them will choose the waveguide. And not only is it expensive, it wouldn't work. If you use the waveguide, let me drop. If you really use the waveguide, because it's got so much loss, because that signal has to bounce back and forth between those walls, every inch and a half, it's making another bounce all the way up to the moon, billions and billions of bounces. If you really use the waveguide, the leakage from the first waveguide joint, 120 decibels attenuated, the leakage from the first joint, radiated into free space, going into the leakage of the last joint on the moon, another 120 dB of leakage, that signal leaking around the waveguide would be 49 million decibels stronger than the signal going down the center of the waveguide. Opposite of common sense. The rule of thumb among smart microwave people is, waveguide is great stuff. Don't use a lot of it. I know I got you off subject, but you're on crazy kinds of propagation. Propagating in the tunnel, propagating through the earth. And now I showed you what you think would be the best propagation in the world, the best waveguide you can buy between earth and the moon. If you could afford it, Bill, don't do it. Take my word for it. And do the calculation. It's a lot of fun. KC2SYL for any other final comments. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Thanks, Dick. I appreciate that. And the analysis of the transmission and so on. The question I really wanted to ask, and if you have a couple of minutes to address it, I wanted to talk about the ANS family. That's the I refer to it as the ANCE family. And members of that family include impedance, capacitance, inductance, and reactance. Trying to get a handle or a better understanding of those concepts and how they work in terms of the radio transmitter and the antenna. and the circuit design. I know it's a big question. It's probably a course for a whole semester, but if you can shed some light on that, I would appreciate it. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, that's a tough one, Bill. I'm not even going to be able to scratch the surface. What I do advise you to do is the couple of very early chapters of the Radio Amateur's Handbook does the best job I know of explaining with some charts, graphs, some formulas, some pretty nice words, what is resistance, what is capacitive reactance, what is inductive reactance, how fast do they change versus frequency, what is the real impedance of a transmission line, what does it mean, an antenna impedance, what does it mean. I'll warn you that real impedance, every device you and I have ever touched, I don't care if it's the world's best so-called 50-ohm dummy load, the world's best antenna, the world's best transmission line, when you get down to the nitty-gritty of making good laboratory measurements with a good vector network analyzer, you'll find everything has a complex impedance. And I'm using the word complex in the mathematical sense. Let me drop. In other words, the manufacturer of that calibration kit that you're using with your network analyzer, made by the company in California, I can't think of the name of them right now, that company may tell you that that is a 50-ohm resistor with extremely high accuracy. You make careful enough measurements, you'll discover that the resistor, that the dummy load, has an impedance of 50.0001 ohms resistive, plus a capacitive reactance of 0.002 ohms, open parentheses, close parentheses. In other words, every real impedance at your favorite radio frequency has a resistive component plus a reactive component. The reactive component means that the current that flows through that component is leading by 90 degrees in phase if it's a capacitor, and lagging by 90 degrees in phase if it's a resistor, if it's an inductor. So you get a phase shift out of the so-called reactive component. You get no phase shift out of the resistive component. You would like the current flowing into your dummy load to have a phase shift between voltage and current that's 0.000 degrees. Well, it may be 0.0015 degrees phase lagging or phase leading. It's not going to be perfect. Nothing is perfect. But the understanding of this, and you get it down to the real world of real antennas, where maybe your reactive component is almost as big as your resistive component, and how does a antenna tuner handle that? What effect does it have on your transmitter, the transmitting efficiency, whether or not the transmitter is happy and draws too much current, and the final stage gets too hot, let me drop, whether or not your receiver is going to give you full performance. I mean, once you do proper impedance matching, and it's called conjugate impedance matching, that's a mathematical word, there's a lot to this. The number of electrical engineers with a bachelor degree coming out of a good electrical engineering school with a major in communications, 4-year degree, I don't care if it's MIT, Stanford, or whatever, RPI, or Georgia Institute of Technology, or Virginia Institute of Technology, any of the really good schools, you get a guy with a bachelor degree in electrical engineering with a major in communications and radio communications coming out of that school, and you ask him a series of questions about resistance, reactance, impedance, susceptance, conductance, transmittance, emittance. You ask them the definitions of those words that describe real impedances in the real world, and you'll rapidly discover that they all feel uncomfortable. They've got a bunch of memorization from the courses they've taken and the tests they've passed and so on. But until they've been in industry for 10 years or more, they don't feel comfortable with those words. 90% of the electrical engineering, the smart guys, the guys with 130 IQs coming out of a good school with a 3.5 grade index, have that uncomfortableness. So if you feel uncomfortable with those subjects, you're in very good company. As I said, you'd be amazed how many of the guys in the antenna engineering department of real smart companies have sitting on their shelf, if they're willing to display it, the Radio Amateur's Handbook, and you'll find out the pages on the resistance and reactance section. I think it's chapter number 2 or 3. Those pages are well worn. So it's going to take some time to learn that. It's not going to be easy, but it's a good thing to learn. And we amateurs, passing information back and forth, some of it is unfortunately erroneous information, but it's one of the very fast learning skills. You want to understand radio and wireless technology, talk to a ham radio operator. In many cases, you'll learn it twice as fast as by any other technique. Back to you for a final on that one, Bill. And I haven't told you what you want to know, but I told you a little bit about how to find out. And it's going to take some time. And you're going to come back in future weeks, ask more questions, and you'll learn more and more. You're about to climb a pretty tall mountain. You're at the foothills right now, and you're not going to be able to climb that mountain immediately. It's going to take some time. KC2SYL, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Thanks, Dick. I probably want to be at least a distant member of the ANTS family. I refer to it as the ANTS family, A-N-C-E. But you gave me a lot of information, and I do have those reference materials, but every time I try to read them, you know, I take it one sentence at a time, trying to understand the concepts and how it relates to the ham radio, especially transmitters and antennas and receivers. But we're making slow progress. Thanks, Dick, and back to that.
From time to time, I find an occasional website that has a very nice animation showing you the phase shift between voltage and current going down a transmission line or going into a loading device on the end of a transmission line where the load is either above or below 50 ohms or has a little bit of inductance or capacitive reactance to it. There are websites that will show you an animation of those waveforms, either as a steady state XY graph, or they'll show you as a moving animation where you actually see the signals moving down that transmission line. They slow down the speed of light, so to speak. It's a slow motion movie. And all of these things will help. There are some pretty good books, not very many. There are some pretty good websites, not very many. And there are a few people that can explain it, not very many. I'll give you one further example of where the situation is. At the height of the success of a company on Long Island with 50-some-odd years of history called Airborne Instruments Laboratory, in roughly 1985, at the height of the B-1B bomber program, which I think was something like a $4 billion contract, big company, 5,500 employees, 1,050 degreed engineers in a company where essentially every single product was radio related. So every engineer that they selected for that company knew something about radio. 1,050 engineers with a 4-year degree or higher, quite a few of them with master's and doctorate degree. That body of people, 1,050 people, at the height of their success, in the middle of that program, approximately 15 of those people had a good working knowledge of how an antenna works and how to design it. 1.5% of the degreed engineers in a company that emphasized nothing but radio products really understood radio. And that was a success story. As you can see, a person who really understands radio is a pretty rare animal. In some cases, I make a joke, you have to make a Faustian bargain in order to get that knowledge. In reality, it takes 10 or 20 years of apprenticeship in the right company to really get a good working knowledge of this area. It's not easy. It's going to take some time. But it's a worthy thing to know, because once you know it, it'll double your job security, because you're one of the rare ones that knows it, Bill. So it's a good thing to pursue. Go for it. Bob is the next person who signed in. W2ILP. Let me drop for a second first. Bob and I went into the wee hours of the morning last Sunday, getting into the nitty-gritty, the nuances of what goes on inside of an antenna tuner, an antenna matchbox. And that's far from a simple subject. Oh, boy. You go on 20 meters any day, and you start telling people what their antenna tuner is doing. And very few people, no matter what you say, are going to agree with you. It's a controversial subject. Bob and I went at it for quite a period of time. I think we arrived at a higher truth. I'm not sure. I guarantee we're going to have a few more discussions because it's far from a simple subject. This is a slightly more complicated version of what you just asked, Bill. So, Bob, W2ILP, go right ahead. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW in the TechNet. This is W2ILP, and my voice is still raspy. I'm getting over a virus that's lasted 2 weeks, and it's under doctor supervision, so it's not life-threatening. But it keeps my voice not as clear as I would like it to be. Every subject that you touched tonight, subjects that I have not only pondered over, but I've given lectures on. The RF safety thing is something that I gave lectures at several ham clubs when the regulations involved the different the distance from antennas and the powers that you could run for yourself, and it was different than what you could expect people walking around your antenna could take. And, I had a great deal of, look at the ignorance. I had a great argument with Ed Hare, who was the NRL lab manager at the time. And one of the problems that arises is that with RF safety, they say that VHF frequencies are more dangerous than microwave frequencies. The VHF frequencies are, let me let it drop because I'm going to talk long.
Yeah, I'm glad you did that. You came close to dropping out. Well done, Bob.
The reason for VHF frequencies was that from the size of a baby to the size of a 6 or 7 foot adult, they said the body would resonate as VHF frequencies. There's a lot of ways that the body can resonate at microwave frequencies. They keep saying that the skin effect and the bones of the body will not allow RF to penetrate. But we have enough holes in our head where RF can penetrate. And I was having trouble seeing with my left eye. And my left eye, when I looked at a horizontal line, would make it look almost as squiggly as a sine wave. And so that the first diagnosis was that I had macular degeneration of the left eye. And from this, I had to see another specialist, and this was at the VA. And he looked at it, called me back to come again in 6 months, see if there'd be any change. And then he came to the conclusion that I don't have macular degeneration. I have scar tissue in my left retina, which is causing a similar symptom. It's not as dangerous as macular degeneration, because it normally won't grow that fast. I'll probably die before it causes any more distortion than it's doing now. And I can't sue any company, because almost every company I worked for has had the opportunity to radiate into my head. I worked on radars, and I worked on microwave equipment, and I worked on all sorts of stuff, including HF antenna tuners outside of the cases. I'll let it drop again. W2ILP is continuing. RF can be dangerous. Now what you're talking about, the fluorescent lighting,